Do you like books? I mean, really, really like books? Then you're in the right place. Each week, your host, Sam Hankin, interviews the best of today's top-selling authors and the up-and-coming superstars of modern literature. This is The Avid Reader. Here is your host, Sam Hankin.
Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to another edition of The Avid Reader. Today, our guest is Lucasta Miller, author of L.E.L., The Lost Life and Scandalous Death of Letitia Elizabeth Landon, the celebrated female Byron. Lucasta is a British critic, biographer, and editor. She's the author of The Bronte Myth. Her articles have appeared in The Guardian, The Economist, and The Independent. She was also a visiting scholar and fellow at Oxford University. L.E.L. was published in March by Knopf. The subtitle of this book, The Lost Life and Scandalous Death of Letitia Elizabeth Landon, the celebrated female Byron, tells us a great deal about this woman.
It's a bit of a mouthful, but given that I was writing a book about somebody who not that many people have heard of, I felt that we really had to pack as much into that subtitle.
And that was to be my first question is, you know, I don't think I'm professing ignorance, because I don't think there are many people anywhere other than you and now everyone who reads your book who knew who this woman was.
Yeah.
And you didn't either.
Well, I mean, there are a few academic specialists in 19th century studies who've heard of her. But yes, indeed. And what I find so extraordinary is that her name has just been completely wiped from the record, as it were, given how well-known she was in her lifetime. I mean, she had an international readership in her lifetime. She was published in German in Germany. She was published in the States. She was popular in France. And she was immensely prolific and a household name, certainly in the UK.
Yeah, and she also... We need to get into it further, but I was also going to say, just as a note, that she also loved her own fame and her celebrity. She was kind of like her biggest fan, wasn't she?
I think she had quite an ambivalent attitude towards it. The words fame and shame rhyme over and over again in her work. And in some ways, she offers quite... a dystopian view of fame. She says, "I lived only in others' breath," and it's a very sort of modern way of looking at the way in which the dissemination of the self can end up sort of hollowing you out. But I wanted just to go back to talking about why we haven't heard of her.
Okay.
And there's a mystery surrounding her, and really, as I discovered during the course of my research, one of the main reasons that you haven't heard of her is that the Victorians calculatedly brushed her under the carpet after she was found dead in suspicious circumstances in West Africa in 1838, at the age of 36, with a bottle of prussic acid in her hand. So there was an element of a sort of almost like a detective element to all the research I put into this. I wanted to find out, you know, why she died, and more about her life.
And her life was very short. And you talk about, she straddled or was close to the lifespans of Byron, Keats, and Shelley. That she was born in 1802, died in 1838. They all had lifespans that were similar. But as in your subtitle, and in every review I've ever read, or even if you go to Wikipedia, for example, everyone calls her the female Byron. And the question is, why?
She was really hyped into being female Byron by the man who was her Svengali, the editor who helped create her as a star, who, it also turns out, although this information was kept under wraps for, over a century and a half, he was also her lover. And so while she was creating this persona for herself as a celebrity on the public stage, she was also, in private, giving birth to three secret illegitimate children, whose discovery would have the potential to destroy her reputation.
Yeah, how do you have three illegitimate children and hide that from the world?
Well, I think it was more of an open secret, certainly among the literati in London. In fact, you know, on one occasion, the Sunday Times newspaper, which had only recently been founded, published a story where the cleaning lady had looked in through the study blinds and seen the couple in flagrante and sold the story to the paper. It was published, but of course, you know, the cleaner in those days, she couldn't take a picture with her phone. It was just hearsay, so Letitia denied it and denied it and denied it. But what's interesting about her is not just this this secret scandal that really only came out when one of her descendants came forward. And I've been in touch with one of her children's descendants, which has been lovely. She didn't actually bring up her children. They were all sent away as soon as they were born. One thing that I find quite extraordinary is that she should have had three. I mean, one illegitimate child when you're a teenager is a mistake, two is a misfortune, but three really is a pattern. The interesting thing about this scandal, however, isn't just that, you know, she was sleeping with her boss, as it were. It's the very complex way in which this background fact that was lost to history for a very long time informs the way that she created her public persona and informs her work. What's ironic about her work, in the early phase of her career at any rate, is the way in which she's creating this vast romantic ego for herself through the mouthpieces, either of fictional female poets or through the first person. A lot of her poems begin with the word I, and yet that I is incredibly ambiguous. She wrote poetry that was able to be read in very different ways by different audiences. She was a master manipulator of reader response. So in the early phase of her career, a lot of the poems on the surface are about sort of flowers and birds. But people in the know could realize that these were metaphors for the rather less sort of respectable subjects of sex and suicide.
Yes, and later in the early 20th century, or maybe even earlier, that was looked at as being very sentimental and too simplistic.
Well, I think that they'd completely lost the fact that any of it was about sex, or that she'd begun her life as a female romantic. In the very early phase of her career, you know, the Keats had recently died, but the people in his circle, the keepers of his flame, regarded her as almost sort of, you know, picking up the baton from where Keats left off. And another writer talks about how Shelley had fallen like a comet, and would Eliel be the moon of our darkness in his wake. And it's because she's writing at a time of increasing repression, in which that generation of romantics who all die in quick succession between 1821 and 1824 are associated in the public mind with rebellion, particularly sexual rebellion. Society is becoming more repressive, both politically and sexually. So it's sort of quite astonishing that this teenage girl creates this voice for herself that is highly erotic, while at the same time performing a sort of fan dance so that she could always sort of deny it and say, oh, it was just flowers and birds.
And it's funny, what was very striking also is that even if you hadn't formed an opinion yet of her prowess in poetry, you have this arcane group of literary icons, the Brontes, Elizabeth Barrett Browning, Edgar Allan Poe, Virginia Woolf. Who am I to say that she's not great after they, you know, praise her?
Yeah, and I don't think Virginia Woolf so much praises her as recoils from her work in some sort of visceral disgust. I think it's a really interesting question about making value judgments about the taste of the past. And I think we often do it at our peril. I mean, for example, the Pre-Raphaelites were laughed at for years and years and years, but they've now become enshrined in the artistic canon. Letitia Landon's voice is very, it's very odd and it's very slippery. It's very difficult to pin down. And it was really a product of a literary culture that was completely fueled by the marketplace. We're talking about an era of tremendous media expansion, the period in which unrestrained capitalism is going through its most sort of aggressive boom and bust growth spurt. She's not the only writer of her generation, this peculiar gap or strange pause, as it's been called, between the Romantics and the Victorians. She's not the only one whose work is no longer read today. And the constraints of the market had a real impact on the way people wrote, and particularly for Eliel, on the notion of authenticity. I mean, today we seem to have quite a Victorian and moral view of poetry, that, you know, we value poetry that can sort of lift up our spirits and talk to us about eternal verities. As a professional writer, Letitia Landon was really quite cynical about the capacity of poetry to reach out beyond the moment or to do anything more than, I think, reflect the fallen nature of the society in which she believed she was living.
You know, it was kind of poignant in when she says in her poem, "I'm simply a woman," almost like a submission to William Jordan. Tell me a little bit more about, were there any redeeming characteristics that this gentleman had with regard to his relationship with her?
Well, people said he was fun, he was full of enthusiasm, he genuinely sort of was interested in promoting literature, but frankly, I don't really feel that he was a huge help to her.
Plus, he took all her money.
Their relationship, though, was quite, it was a lot more complex than that. And her, she often, in her poetry, she will create these tragic female characters who are larger than life. They're a little bit like, you know, the typical opera heroine who is played by this great diva who dominates all the action but always has to get killed at the end. So this sort of almost masochistic play between sort of power and destruction is running through a lot of poetry. And I think there was a lot more irony and in her work as regards him than you might imagine. I mean, she's slightly sort of mocking him where she turns the men for whom her heroines hunger into these excessively sort of beautiful young men with sort of dark Byronic curls, and they're always slightly sort of limp and emasculated. Whereas he, of course, was much older than her and to some extent, of course, held the power. But on the other hand, I mean, that relationship between the impresario and the talent, it's often quite unclear as to exactly where the power lies, because he needed her as much as she needed him.
And in the most prosaic sense, as you were talking earlier about capitalism, when you did your research at the library, you found her name nowhere, and which meant that he essentially took all of her money.
Well, I mean, that was particularly for the poems she wrote in his magazine, the Literary Gazette. And yes, this was one of the things that, I mean, that was one piece of research, which was, it's really interesting, and that was one of the very first things I did when I began this project. I remember looking at these accounts and being really baffled, you know, why isn't her name here? And it took me a little bit, you know, a few weeks for the penny to drop and realise, ah, he didn't pay her. She did, of course, get money for the book she published rather than the popular poetry column, but he was her agent, her treasurer, her accountant, and he was completely hopeless with money. And he eventually goes bankrupt, and because their finances are so joined at the hip, she's sort of thrust into terrible financial difficulties too. Yes, so at that really basic level, there's a sort of there's a real lack of empowerment there for her, and in her poetry she will often use these rather glamorized images of female poets as being like these slave girl singers in sort of oriental harems, and there's a sort of really rather horrible and banal reality to that.
Unfortunately, it sounds very much like many of the things that are happening today, and I guess have happened for years, whether it's in Hollywood or New York or wherever. It's not much
different. Yeah, I mean, I've certainly been quite intrigued by some of the responses. There's one woman critic, in fact, writing in the Italian press, who said something like, you know, in this age of Me Too, Letitia Landon's life and work should be taught in schools.
Yeah, it's an excellent life lesson. First of all, don't have three illegitimate children. It's a lot easier not to now.
Yeah, I mean, but of course things were even harder for women in that era. I mean, women on the whole did not negotiate their own literary contracts. I mean, Jane Austen, for example, got her brother to do it for her. And of course, the really huge difference to today is the social death that would follow from public knowledge that you had a child out of wedlock.
Yeah, and Eliel's brother was no help either.
Oh no, sadly not. Poor old Whittington. but he seems to have been as drawn into the circle of William Jerdan, the editor, as much as she was.
That's interesting. He must have been a rather weak person, I would have imagined. Because
yes. I mean, the brother does seem to have been quite a weak person. She, however, was not perceived of as being a weak person at all by her contemporaries, because, on the one hand, she's publishing all this poetry. On the other hand, she's also going around the sort of social scene, and she's regarded as a sort of Dorothy Parker-like figure, you know, a great wit, and people are totally intrigued by the disjunction between the tragic voice of her poetry and the sort of sardonic humour that she comes out with at parties. In a funny way, it's a bit like the sort of distinction between cynicism and sentimentality that Oscar Wilde quips about, and didn't he say that sentimentality is the bank holiday of cynicism? And, you know, those two sides are two sides of the same coin, really. In fact, something that you can see in Wilde's own work when you compare, you know, the wit of his plays with the sentiment of his fairy tales. And in many ways, her career, in fact, I think, rather was a sort of pre-run for what he was doing when he was sort of taking enormous risks in terms of his exposure, in his case because he was gay, in her case because she was a single mother. And they're these gamblers on a tightrope walk. And Letitia Landon was a gambler. She knew she was gambling on her reputation, and sometimes she got an immense thrill when she was able to, you know, through her ability to hide in plain sight. At other times, more towards the end of her career, she became increasingly terrified that the truth would out, and that she would become persona non grata and she wouldn't be able to publish anymore.
And it's very true. It's because she's a woman. Because if you think of Wilde, it was more his... He was, you know, hung up by his own... hoisted by his own petard because his excess of cynicism, and at the trial saying he wasn't even attractive, he kind of made his own bed, whereas because Letitia was a woman, she didn't particularly do anything offensive that caused
her... Well, I mean, I think she did make her own bed because, you know, when she writes because some of her writing was, you know, pushed the boundaries of taste so far with its eroticism. I mean, for example, in the poem that first made her famous, when she describes in the first person the heroine, who is an improvisatrice, which is an Italian poet performer, and she talks about, you know, my hand was wandering on my lute and music most unconsciously, my pulses throbbed, my sense beat high, a throb of dizzy ecstasy crimsoned my cheek, or something like that. I mean, it's basically completely masturbatory. Keats had used the image of the lute as a very sort of vulgar image for the female genitals in the Eve of St. Agnes, leading his contemporaries to think it was a poem that was unfit for ladies. And Letitia now takes this up, and it would certainly have been read like that by a huge section of her contemporary audience. Though, of course, on the other hand, another section of her audience would just think that, you know, she was a sweet, innocent girl who was just writing about playing the lute.
Yeah, but that's part of the reason why these young boys who later became great authors would run down to the corner to get the magazine that had her poem in the one little corner of it.
Yeah, I also think that she, even her early work was read by women, and it was a way in which they could read about forbidden things without, you know, with it going under the radar. Later on in her career, her image, she tries to change her image and move it away from this eroticism. You have to remember that the period of her career coincides with a huge cultural change between, at the beginning of her career, the ideal of the great writer is the transgressive figure of Byron, who's gone into exile because of his sexual transgressions. By the end of the era, the ideal figure of the author is recreated by Dickens as being a sort of in the image of Victorian family values. And she is this transitional figure who ends up falling foul of that.
But there were, even though we keep talking about she was a woman in this man's world, there were an increasing number of famous women poets during that transitional period, correct?
Yes, there were. Her main English rival was called Felicia Hemans, and she had a very different voice. She very much promoted emotion as a moral force, and she focused on domesticity and the values of family and the home. I mean, in fact, in private, she herself had a really difficult life. She was separated from her husband, desperately trying to support her children. And in fact, Letitia at one point rather bitchily exposes this less than respectable fact about Mrs. Hemans to the public. But there was a greater, what was called the poetess phenomenon, that was international. In fact, there were women poets writing in France and Germany and Russia, and many of them were inspired by the best-selling book Corinne by Madame de Charles.
Oh, yes.
Which portrayed a female poet as a great tragic heroine. It was based on the real life story of I'm not going to get into all that, it's too complicated. You're going to have to edit this bit too.
That's all right.
The really interesting thing about the poetess phenomenon is that there's a certain ambiguity about, you know, what is a woman writer for and what is her social position? Is she on a continuum with the actress, or is she supposed to be a moralist who's telling us didactically what we ought to be doing?
What's funny,
and Letitia Landon was certainly on the side of the actress.
Well, at some point or another, after Jordan and after the scandal, she decides to become more of a, I guess, not pedestrian, but more of a regular, normal person, and she meets George MacLean. And he just seems like much more of a down-to-earth, regular, good guy. In American.
Oh, well, I don't know. I don't know if he, I think that's That's a bit of a simple reading of him, I think. George MacLean was the governor of Cape Coast Castle in West Africa, which is a former slaving fort, and he'd come over to England on a brief home leave. At this point, Letitia's friends were very, very, very keen to get her off the scene. Her behaviour was becoming more and more erratic. She was more and more terrified that the truth about her private life was going to be used against her. And also her female friends in particular were finding her more and more of a social contaminant because, you know, a lady's respectability depended on the company she kept. So her marriage to this man was in many ways almost arranged. It was her one escape route at a time when she was really suffering because a previous engagement had broken off because her fiancé had received anonymous letters detailing the truth about her private life. And of course, the engagement broke up.
Yes, and how did she get him back? Where did he go off to? Did he go off to Scotland, MacLean?
Oh, no, I think... We're slightly talking at cross purposes.
Yes.
I was referring to John Forster earlier, right. That she'd had this earlier engagement to John Forster, whose breakdown had put her in a more and more exposed and perilous position.
Because he heard the rumors, and then she said, if you want to go look into this, go ahead and look into this, and right, you know.
Yeah, well, she said, she writes him this letter written in this very sort of, like the language of cheap melodrama, saying sort of, I cannot put you, make you go through with this. How could you possibly link yourself to a woman who has even been sort of, where any suspicion could possibly have been raised against her, although, of course, none of it's true. Of course, you know, the main difficulty was that, of course, it
was true. Well, so if we're back on MacLean now, didn't he also kind of try to escape from the relationship?
Yes, he did. He felt that he'd been maneuvered into it. And he was, not just by Letitia's friends, but by the man who introduced them. And at this point, the story gets really complicated, and this is one of the most fascinating aspects of doing this research. MacLean was introduced to Letitia Landon by a wealthy businessman with who was involved in a lot of import-export with West Africa. To cut a long story short, this guy wanted... contacts in high places because the British government was very sort of suspicious of the fact that the merchants were actually contravening the slave trading laws. And I think that he thought that Letitia's fame and the fact that she did in fact have access to some important men in politics might be a very, very useful contact. And he very much encouraged the marriage.
Well,
it turns out, of course, that these big businessmen were indeed breaking the slave trading legislation. They were not acting within the law, and that MacLean was in a very, very difficult position, caught between the government, who wanted to be seen to be clamping down on the slave trade, and the merchant, who were in fact his masters, because the government had sort of outsourced the appointment of the governor to this committee of private businessmen. So almost sort of totally unexpectedly, in a way, you're telling a story about an English poet and you end up delving into this rather dark and really fascinating history of the British slave trade, which is an area of history which has only really very recently begun to be really delved into and unpicked, because although the British made the slave trade illegal in 1807, it did not end, one sort of blow like that.
But it's interesting because, as you say, this is where it gets really tricky, and it's almost cinematic. It's almost like you're watching a movie there towards the end. What's fascinating to me is that all of what you're saying about what is now Ghana and the slave trade and all that, she was only there for, what, 2 months, something like that?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So it's... So she was found dead, about 2 months after arriving there.
And the interesting thing to me was, when I was researching to talk to you, is that prussic acid, and I know there's all the theories about her death, and you discuss them quite clearly in the book, but it's basically cyanide. But there also is that syndrome, Stokes-Adams syndrome, which could be cured today with a pacemaker. So there's either the fact that that might have been her prescription.
Yes. I mean, you know, from the very earliest biography that was written of her in 1845, there were attempts to say that she died of natural causes and that prussic acid wasn't really involved, and of course there were the other claims that she'd in fact been murdered by George MacLean's African mistress. She wasn't murdered. She was taking prussic acid, even though her doctor denied that he had prescribed it for her. It's quite clear if you read his medical textbooks that he's constantly recommending it for every ailment, including as a topical application for acne. It was definitely in medicinal use at that time. She was taking it because it was a narcotic. She was already highly addicted to laudanum, and basically, if you were so addicted to that that it wasn't really working anymore, prussic acid was the next step.
Oh, how horrible. I mean, it's just a horrible thing to take. There are lots of different theories about her death, and we've just discussed the fact that she regularly took this as basically she became addicted to it. But there are numerous conspiracy theories regarding her death, and without asking you to disclose them, because this book is almost like a mystery. Talk about some of those, just the conspiracies, the different theories behind how her death was perceived back in London, where it wasn't even known for some weeks or months.
Yes, as soon as the news reached London, various rumors started flying, one of which was that she had been murdered by the African partner of George MacLean, who in fact did already have a relationship with an African woman and it seemed several children with her. This was indeed the case. Country marriages, as they were called, were really very, very common with European men who were stationed in far-flung places like this for years at a stretch. And they weren't sort of casual relationships. They were effectively like marriages, but if the man went home, he did have the right to end the relationship, but the woman had to be compensated. In fact, you know, in many ways, these country marriages gave the women more rights than Letitia had ever had as the mistress of William Jerdon. Anyway, there's absolutely no evidence that Ellen MacLean, which was the name of George MacLean's country wife, conspired to murder Letitia, possibly with the connivance of MacLean himself. That was alleged. One of the reasons why the story became so muddied and lurid rumours like the murder rumour were able to flourish was because there was indeed a cover-up surrounding Cape Coast Castle. It was less to do with Letitia than to do with the completely separate question of illegal involvement in the slave trade. The Merchant Committee did not want the spotlight of publicity shining on their dark nook of colonial dependency, as it was called, because they had all sorts of things to do with their business dealings that they wanted to hide.
Well, let's leave that be so that the reader can enjoy reading about it, but let's talk about, briefly in closing, let's talk about the resurgence of Letitia. You know, you can talk a little bit, perhaps, Germaine Greer and that movement, and a little bit why she has now become in great part because of you, why she's become popular again. Why is she something that we're ready for?
Yes, as a result of the interest in women's writing that sort of grew through the 70s and 80s, Letitia Landon did become of more interest to critics in that period. And there was a particularly interesting long chapter on her by Germaine Greer in her book Slipshod Sibyls. Although Germaine Greer came to the conclusion that Letitia Landon was a virgin, a sort of virgin fantasist, which, as we now know, is totally wrong. And then in 2000, this descendant of Letitia Landon's called Michael Gorman, who's currently living in Japan, got in touch with a PhD student who was working on Landon and told her that that he was a descendant. And this student, Cynthia Lawford, published an article in the London Review of Books in 2000 putting across this this new allegation that Letitia Landon had not been the virgin that everybody had thought she was, but had in fact had these children. So Cynthia Lawford was the person who first published this, and it was absolutely wonderful that she began to crack this open, but not many people really picked up on it. The thing is that it raised so many more questions than it answered, and what I've tried to do is to get really, really deep into the full cultural context of Letitia Landon and weave the story of her personal life in with the poetry.
And you did it in a fascinating way, and I thoroughly enjoyed the book. And you don't know, but I have an independent bookstore here in the States, and your book is already out there on the front table and doing quite well. So I wanted to thank you so much for being here and for explaining things so succinctly. I really appreciate it.
Gosh, well, thank you very much. I don't really feel I was that succinct. It's jolly hard to summarize this book.
Yeah, I know. It very much is. And that's why I say it's
so multi-stranded. But it's lovely to talk to you. Thank you very much indeed. I'll really look forward to listening to it.
So we were talking with LaCosta Miller. Her book is L.E.L. with the relatively long subtitle, The Lost Life and Scandalous Death of Letitia Elizabeth Landon, the Celebrated Female Byron. And as I said in the beginning, the subtitle gives you a lot of information about what the book contains. And this is a woman who nobody knew anything about until one of her descendants stuck his head up in 2000 and started talking a little bit about her. And then Germaine Greer earlier had spoken about her in a chapter of one of her books. But she was all the rage when, in her short life, she was writing poetry in London. After the Romantic period, before the Victorian period, in what they called the Great Pause. In any event, it was a fascinating interview, and it's almost a cinematic-type book about a person that, as I said, none of us know about, but once you find out about her, she kind of fills in some of the gaps that you might have had in your knowledge of England in this period, as Byron was dying and Shelley and Keats also were. After very short lives as well. In any event, continue to join us. I know you've listened to a lot of really good authors in the past here, in the past few weeks, actually, and we have plenty more coming up. We're still working with a lot of them, so for a complete schedule as we move along, visit us at our website, wellingtonsquarebooks.com. You can go to the radio stations, WCHE1520.com, or you can simply download our podcasts at iTunes or Podomatic. And if you have an iPhone or an iPad, the icon for podcasts is automatically included now. So you just click podcasts, type The Avid Reader, type L.E.L., Lost Life, or LaCosta Miller, and you'll be able to access it immediately. So thanks as always for joining us today, and we look forward to having you back here next week on The Avid Reader.